Hey, folks, you're listening to the free version of Ring of Fire Radio. I want to thank you for listening to the program, supporting us by downloading this podcast every week. But there's more that you are missing. We have three times the content every week available on our member show. Not only that, our member show is completely ad-free. And on top of it all, it just costs literally pennies a day. Head over to ROFpodcast.com, sign up for the show, get it fully delivered to you via your podcast player. Ring of Fire membership also includes access to over 10 years worth of archives. Check it out, folks. It's your support that keeps us on the air. Thanks again for listening. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, education policy expert Kevin Carey will be here to explain how corporations have hijacked our higher education system. Josh Holland from The Nation magazine will lay out his case on why Congress should start impeachment proceedings against the president. Heather Digby Parton from Salon will join me to analyze all the big news stories from this week. And John Washington will join us to explain what a world with open borders might look like. Hey, if you're new to the show, you can find the free one-hour podcast, Ring of Fire Radio, on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever your podcasts are listened to. There's also a member show, which can allow you to support Ring of Fire Radio by becoming a member and getting our three-hour radio show commercial-free and access to all of our archives. You can go to ROF, that's Ring of Fire, ROFpodcast.com to sign up. Here to run down the biggest stories of the week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her, Digby. So, Heather, quite a bit of news this week about the around the, well, broadly speaking, the investigations of the president. But within the context of the Mueller investigation, we found out really on the eve of Bill Barr, the attorney general, his testimony in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee, the eve of that testimony, we found out through reporting in the Washington Post that Robert Mueller was indeed unhappy with the way that Bill Barr basically unfurled the results of the Mueller investigation to the American public. And you know, we'll get more specific about this, but it seems to me, and it came through the reporting of a letter that Mueller sent to Bill Barr shortly after Bill Barr had, I guess, in Bill Barr's words, not summarized, but restated or announced the results of the Mueller investigation. Robert Mueller felt, and I think broadly speaking, you tell me if you think I'm contextualizing this wrong, but it seems to me he was basically writing like, your spin on this is not informing the public accurately. I mean, that seems to be the accusation, really, when you boil it down from the Mueller letter. And then Bill Barr showed up at Senate Judiciary. I mean, that's more or less where we were right at the beginning of those hearings.
Absolutely, and it was really quite astonishing when the story broke that Mueller had sent this letter and that they'd had a subsequent phone call, and that Mueller was unhappy essentially with the way that Barr had put out that four-page letter showing what he considered to be the conclusions, and which it seems to me obvious that Mueller did not agree with Barr's characterization of that. He certainly felt, and I guess we'll find out more details if Mueller ever testifies, but what he seems to have felt at the very least was that the fact that Barr did it the way that he did led to a lot of speculation, and one assumes, this would apply to Trump's trumpeting, no total exoneration, no collusion, no obstruction, totally vindicated, all that stuff on the basis of that four-page letter, and that Mueller was upset about that for obvious reasons, because once we saw the full report, we could see he didn't say that at all. And so he was upset about that, and it seemed clear. And in fact, veterans of the Department of Justice say the fact that Mueller even wrote that letter, in other words, what they call it, something like putting it to paper or something, that
right.
When you do that, you make it an official document coming from the Office of Special Counsel. But that was really a very aggressive thing to do, because normally this would be done through discussions, back channels and kind of person-to-person discussion about it. But it was memorialized in this letter, and that they considered to be a sign that Mueller was way more upset than even the letter itself sounded, simply by the fact that he did it. So that was where we were, and it came as a big surprise, because I think that, one of the things that people have been saying was, hey, if Barr did anything wrong, don't you think Mueller would have said something? Well, apparently he did, and of course,
right.
Him being the ultimate sort of straight arrow institutionalist guy, he didn't go running to the press with it, although you recall, for the first time since this investigation started, there was some little leaking that came through in the week or so after Barr's letter, saying that, members of Mueller's team had told friends that they were upset about the way that it happened. We did get a sense that there was something going on there, but it turns out to have been a much bigger deal than we knew.
And we should say that when Mueller testified in that time, he... when he was being questioned, I think it was by Charlie Crist in the House Judiciary hearing, this is a couple of weeks ago, he very adroitly avoided the sort of the premise of the question and just addressed the technicality of the question. I don't know what the people working on Mueller's team are, had any complaints with it. Now, what he did know is that Mueller himself did have a complaint. And of course, I mean, in some respects, and I want to get to the more recent hearings, but in some respects, my sense is that Mueller has been, outplayed or outwitted in the context of the politics involved in this, and that his fealty to the institution of the Department of Justice is not, well, I guess, positioned to help the country in the way that he thinks he's helping the country, right? In other words, like, you and I both remember the Ken Starr independent counsel. Now, and of course, it was different because it was an independent prosecutor as opposed to a special prosecutor. But nevertheless, Ken Starr played a ruthless political game. They had leaks. Brett Kavanaugh was supposedly one of the official go-to leakers on that committee. They had leaks. They positioned things. They placed stories. And Mueller didn't do any of that. And it seems to me like he's getting a little bit outplayed by Bill Barr.
I totally agree. And I think I understand the impulse. You probably feel it too, and so do I, that, somebody's got to be an adult, somebody's got to be, following the rules or else everything turns into chaos. But that you can't in this environment. I mean, to play by the rules that Robert Mueller is playing by is to not recognize the reality. You said that he was, trying to, he was pledging fealty to the Department of Justice, the place where he spent his whole adult life working. It's not the same Department of Justice. And we know that because we know that, first of all, they purged a whole bunch of people out of the FBI and the Department of Justice, anyone who had defied their, had done any kind of independent investigation. They found ways to get rid of them. I mean, to me, that's sort of an undercovered story. The fact that all of these people are gone, that that launched an investigation when they found out that there was this election interference. I mean, that seems pretty, you know, pretty serious to me. So this Department of Justice, which is now running interference for the White House under the direction of Bill Barr and Rod Rosenstein, who we were sort of forced to put our hopes in that he would be fair. It turns out that he may be one of the weakest sisters ever to be in a role like that, because he, you know, constantly he was trying to walk that line, and he ended up doing it, you know, when you've got people like Trump, and then with Barr, when he came in, a guy like Rosenstein also got rolled in a much more obvious way. But, you know, in his own way, Mueller did too. And, you know, I it's not over yet, because Mueller will be testifying, and we'll see whether or not he can rise to the occasion after having been more or less attacked by the institution that he was trying to protect. And nice. That is, there's just no doubt in my mind after watching Barr testify that it really was an attack on Mueller. His representation of Mueller being sort of a, you know, a ditherer who didn't really know what he was doing. And, you know, it was my baby, right? Once he turned it over, he said, that changes things.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more. I'm Sam Cedar, Ring of Fire Radio.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, we're talking about the Mueller report, and in particular, we're talking about Bill Barr's relationship to it. And it is the case that we now see the Mueller report. Now, different people see different things in that report. It's clear that there was Mueller's investigation that there are no more indictments. There was already several dozen. He did not pursue any obstruction indictment on a conspiracy charge. Collusion is not a legal term. Some people would say there was no collusion because there was no active conspiring. No one from the Trump campaign helped in any way the Russian government with their election interfering activities. But others would say, well, collusion is when you are working in concert with someone. It doesn't necessarily require coordination, but, you know, if I know you like it when I, you know, honk my horn out in front of somebody's house to irritate them, Heather, and you know I like cookies, and you leave cookies out on the lawn, and I go eat the cookies, and then I keep honking, and you leave more cookies, you know, someone could argue that's collusion, right? And it was clear that there was some of that going on. It's not 100% sure exactly, you know, what are the cookies and what are the horn honking that's going on. But there was definitely some of that. And then the obstruction, Mueller quite clearly left the obstruction charge up to Congress. I mean, the report very clearly states, like, we're not in a position. There's enough evidence here that if we were not barred by the OLC to indict the DOJ, the indict a sitting president, we probably would. It doesn't phrase it quite like that, but the structure is like, there's no point in us, you know, moving forward because we can't indict. However, there are, I think I'm paraphrasing, but pretty darn close, constitutional procedures to hold someone to account, a president to account in this. And People can read the Constitution. It's called impeachment. I mean, so he was clearly leaving this up to Congress, and Bill Barr stepped in and said, actually, he wasn't, and we've decided there's nothing there. Now, that doesn't preclude Congress, but it certainly was the strategy, right? Let's give us 2 or 3 months of making the presumption being that this report obliterated all the charges against the president.
Absolutely. And it's clear, and it was clear to me when I finally, you know, slogged my way through the 400 and some pages of it, that this was an impeachment referral. I mean, there's really no doubt about it. It, even on the collusion, which they found, you know, that there was no evidence. They were unable to establish that there was any kind of a conspiracy under the criminal statute and definition of conspiracy. But what they did say was that the Trump campaign benefited and welcomed the Russian interference and knew about it. And we all know they did. They, you know, Don Jr. said, I love it, you know, send me more. I mean, they were meeting with these people. Trump was saying, I love WikiLeaks. He was saying, you know, Russia, if you're listening. I mean, it was clear that they knew that they, what was happening, and they were benefiting from it, and they welcomed it. So, you know, but Mueller didn't put that in there for nothing. I mean, all of that, as it was laid out, was an impeachment referral. And according to the reports that came out on Tuesday night around this Mueller letter, what the DOJ's response to that, meaning Barr and his own personal toadies that are in there, you know, working with him now, including Rosenstein at the time, they were offended that Mueller did that, that he wrote a report that was apparently designed to be public. And what Mueller said in his letter was, you know, by doing what you did, Attorney General, you are undermining the public's confidence in the work that we produced and the evidence that we are laying out here. That's the division between the two. Barr and his toadies and the Trump administration wanted Mueller to just file a confidential memo to Barr saying, this is what we decided. It's, you know, here's all the paperwork if you want to go delve into it. But basically, this is what we decided. They basically wanted that 4-page memo. And Mueller didn't do that. He wrote a very, very detailed report that was clearly designed to go to Congress and to go to the public, which, you know, there was no guarantee that was going to happen. Barr could have, you know, stonewalled the entire document. He didn't have any requirement to send it to Congress, although we know that Congress would have subpoenaed it and there would have been a big battle over it. And they figured that it wasn't politically feasible. But they were mad at Mueller for writing that report the way he did. And it sounds as though Mueller is mad back at the Barr and the DOJ for trying to hide that, or at least get out some kind of, you know, get out Barr's PR damage control document well in advance of seeing the report, so they could kind of taint the jury pool, as it were.
Right.
So, you know, this is going to be a very interesting thing, because I think we have a battle here, and we'll just see how well Mueller holds up, because I don't know if he will or not. I mean, we'll have to see if he gets to testify.
I mean, I think it's quite likely that Mueller is going to testify. It seems harder and harder to imagine a scenario going forward where Congress doesn't begin to assert itself. And let's take a break, because I just want to stay on this just a little bit more, because it's fascinating to me. It is we're almost seeing more assertiveness against Barr than we are Trump. And the politics around that are, I think, are fascinating. Speaking of politics, we also will catch up on the Democratic primary. Is, you know, premature as it may seem, we are less than, what, about 6 weeks away from the first debate, folks. It's not our fault. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Ring of Fire, and Digby will join me in the next hour. Just ahead, the debate to impeach has begun. Josh Holland will be here to tell us why Congress's duty is crystal clear. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. I've always done the best I could to get out of my neighborhood. Growing up, I spilled my blood, but you're still my home. You stay within my bones. Saturday night on the highest floor. Hey, folks, Mike Papantonio's new book entitled Law and Vengeance, which is the follow-up to his critically acclaimed novel Law and Disorder, is finally out and available to you to buy. The book is a legal and political thriller drawing on Papp's experience both as a skilled trial lawyer and as a nationally syndicated political talk show host. The story follows trial lawyer Gina Romano, who was first introduced in Law and Disorder, on her quest for both vengeance and justice in a whistleblower lawsuit against a weapons manufacturer who developed and sold a dangerously defective rifle scope. Papp has built a story around real-life events that he's encountered as one of the top trial lawyers in America, where he's been fighting some of the world's largest and most corrupt corporations. Buy Mike Papantonio's new book, Law and Vengeance, today. Go to www.lawandvengeance.com. That's lawandvengeance.com. Check it out. I know you're going to love it. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. The debate to impeach has begun after the release of the Mueller report. Here to explain why Congress now has a clear path for impeachment, Joshua Holland from The Nation magazine. So, Josh, as we speak, there's even more, I guess, clamoring, if you will, for impeachment. But let's just back up and look at the various sort of arguments that are being made. Nancy Pelosi put some cold water on the idea of impeachment, it seemed to me, on the day that she arrived and returned as Speaker of the House. Give me your assessment of what that was about.
Well, at that point, you know, we need to keep in mind that she did not speak in absolute terms. She said that it had to be that impeachment would only be appropriate if the circumstances warranted. And that was long before the Mueller report came out. More recently, her position was that the information that you could get in an impeachment hearing or an impeachment inquiry is no different than what you could get by holding hearings in, say, the Judiciary Committee or the House Oversight Committee or whatever. And for me, the problem with that is that you can hold those hearings, you can call the same witnesses, you can drag Don McCann in. That is the former White House counsel who was there for many of Trump's obstructive acts. And, you know, political junkies will tune in, but it doesn't have the same kind of spectacle that hearings would have if you attach the word impeachment to them. And for me, that's an important point. You know, we need to cut through the noise. There are tens of millions of people who have no idea what Robert Mueller found because they've heard about the report through their preferred media outlets. If they're conservatives, they've probably heard that there was absolutely no evidence of wrongdoing whatsoever. And if you had impeachment hearings or an impeachment inquiry, and we could talk about the difference, I think that it would be really compelling, must-watch TV. I think that all of the networks would have to carry it live. And you would get tens of millions of people viewing, tuning in and seeing what the witnesses have to say without that filter. And I think this is a key point. You know, we need to understand that Trump is adept at creating so much noise and just flooding the zone with nonsense. And we move on from stories very quickly. And, you know, we need to hold this one in the news.
Okay. So now when we talk about, and all right, so there's a lot of different sort of branches to this, and we should say that right now, even amongst Democratic voters, there is not a majority to impeach. Now, probably at least in some part, it is a function of A, the absence of those hearings, and B, the idea that there has been at least a concerted effort to ratchet down, I guess, the intensity of calls for impeachment by, it seems to me, by the Democratic leadership. But let's talk about just what impeachment is, because impeachment is not like on Thursday we're going to vote to impeach, right? Or it's a process. I mean, so just walk us through that. You mentioned the difference between hearings and an inquiry.
Yes.
Let's talk about this so that we're on the same page, and then we can sort of assess it as to whether impeachment is necessary from a sort of like a protection of our democracy and just a functioning of good government. And then also we can talk about it from a political perspective, and I'm talking partisan politics, because as we know, impeachment is inherently a political process. But go
ahead. That's right. Yes, that's correct. So, I mean, just to walk you through it briefly, you can file articles of impeachment, as several progressive Democrats have done. You can hold hearings in the Judiciary Committee. They can vote them out. The entire House then would have to vote to indict the president effectively. And then the two House managers would go to the Senate. The Senate would have a impeachment committee. The Democratic House members would lay out the case, and then the entire Senate would have to vote to convict and remove the president from office. That requires a two-thirds supermajority. You can indict in the House with just a simple majority. The alternative is that...
And let me just clarify one thing, too, that when those House managers go to the Senate, this is not a situation, that's a privileged motion, right? I mean, in other words, that's not something
They must hold hearings.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
McConnell can't just bury that. This is all, you know, this is a constitutional function of Congress, and it's not something that he could just let die. And of course, you know, there is no chance that you're going to get 20 Republican senators to join Democrats to convict. And we should come back to that point in a moment. The other alternative, and I think that this is important to understand, is that you don't have to go full speed to impeachment. You can begin an impeachment inquiry in the Rules Committee. It would have, I think, the same amount of sizzle because you've attached impeachment to the name of that hearing. And that's a preliminary thing. If the Rules Committee finds adequate evidence of crimes and misdemeanors, and again, as you point out, it's a political process, they would then vote that out to the Judiciary Committee, and the process that we just talked about would start.
I see. Is there, aside from when we talk about, and then I guess the third track is you have hearings in, I don't know, the judiciary that wants to...
Judiciary and oversight, yeah.
Or oversight committees that wants to just accumulate, that looks to accumulate evidence, that are looking into what Deutsche Bank, on and on and on, these various different sort of areas in which they could examine. To be clear about those basically three tracks that we're talking about, right? Aside from the moniker attracting more attention and therefore giving sort of creating a newsworthy enough event that the public can become more informed and more aware of the reasoning behind it, are there any other sort of technical advantages that come from associating these inquiries or investigation with the word impeachment?
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you asked that. It's a really good question. There is at present a standoff over subpoenas, over the entire Mueller report, including grand jury testimony. William Barr, the Attorney General, is withholding that information from the Judiciary Committee. And there is an important provision in the law that says that grand jury testimony can be released preliminary to or pursuant to a judicial investigation or judicial process. Now, I talked to a bunch of lawyers, and they said, well, if the Judiciary Committee is holding hearings, judges should say that qualifies as a 6E exemption, is what it's called. But if you get the wrong judge, or if you get the right judge from Trump's perspective, and that judge rules against them, you have a much stronger case when it is a judicial process. So it adds a lot of weight and gravitas to the demands that Congress is making, because now it's not just oversight. Now it's oversight pursuant to Congress's, you know, constitutional function of checking and balancing the presidency. And it's one big way of doing that. It's one primary tool, which is impeachment.
That's fascinating. So attaching the word impeachment to there just gives a lot more authority to these inquiries and makes it a lot harder to deny these committees the information. All right, let's take a break here and let's talk about the arguments for and against the Democrats, and some of which we've covered, from beginning to initiate this process in one form or another. And also, I want to address the question, is what does Donald Trump really want the Democrats to do here? And I guess maybe a subsidiary question, does that matter? We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Joshua Holland right after this.
Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.
We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now, I'm talking to Josh Holland about his piece in The Nation magazine. The politics of impeachment may be debatable, but Congress's duty is clear. So, Josh, in the last segment, you basically walked through the different scenarios in which impeachment could begin and processes it could follow. One would be just oversight committees, judicial committees, investigating the myriad of different things that should be investigated in the Trump administration. The second would be an initial impeachment inquiry, which would then determine whether hearings were necessary, and then they would kick that bill out to judiciary, and they would start to begin hearings, or go directly to hearings. And then I guess the other alternative is just do nothing and hope everything gets better.
And beat them in 2020.
Right. Well, but and these are not mutually exclusive by any means. I think some people would argue, and let's maybe address that, is before we get to the political implications about it one way or another, what's the argument to do this impeachment in terms of, like, government, in terms of holding people to account?
I think it's twofold. Since the Mueller report came out, and with Democrats showing that they're wary of impeachment, Trump has become even more lawless, even expressed even more disdain for the checks and balances, the Congress's oversight role. He has ordered multiple people to violate the law. He told his DHS nominee, then the head of CPB, that if he violated the law and got in trouble, Trump would pardon him. This is very serious stuff from the President of the United States, and they're sending a signal by downplaying the possibility of impeachment that he can get away with all of this. And the classic formula in law enforcement is that impunity breeds more lawlessness, right? Think about broken windows theory. The other point is that,
or Iran-Contra, or savings and loan, or or the pardoning
on,
from Watergate. Yes, I mean,
or impunity for human rights violators.
Right.
I mean, this is, you know, pretty
torture.
Well understood.
Yes.
Yeah. And then the other thing is it sends a signal to future presidents that impeachment is too politically fraught, and they don't have to worry about it unless the other party has overwhelming majorities in both chambers of Congress, which is unlikely to happen given how closely divided we are. So I think it sets a very bad precedent. You know, there's one argument that I think is salient is that the founders, I mean, if you get into the constitutional issues here, the founders did not give us many options, a wide array of options to deal with a lawless president. They foresaw the possibility, and they gave us basically oversight and impeachment. So I think that it's important to look at this in the context of what's happening now. This is not just about what Robert Mueller found. the lawlessness and contempt for the other branches of government is happening right now, and I think it's escalating. And Trump has said repeatedly that he feels that the Supreme Court is a backstop for him. So, you know, you don't have the check from the judicial branch necessarily. Right. This is what we have.
Okay. In terms of, I guess, the, I don't know if I would call it the moral compunction, but the ethical compulsion to impeach. Let's talk about the political realities. I mean, I think there is a sense that the Democratic leadership is afraid of impeachment. The very often we see our politicians operate under the lessons of the, you know, metaphorically speaking, the last war. Bill Clinton, when he was impeached, it helped his popularity in many respects. I mean, I think there's really no other way to assess that. What's the political argument? And give it to us whether you think that political argument is even relevant in light of the sort of the ethical argument.
Yeah, I mean, so first of all, I think that it's you're exactly right to say that they're fighting the last war. Bill Clinton, we can look back on Bill Clinton's presidency in retrospect and find a lot of problems, but it doesn't change the simple fact that in late 1998, Bill Clinton had a 64% approval rate, 35% disapproved. That's a net approval of plus 29 points. Very, very popular presidency at the time. In the previous 17 Gallup polls that year, his approval had dropped under 60% in three of them, 57, 58%. So you're talking about kind of the peak of his popularity. Trump, on the other hand, is consistently at minus 10 net approval. He's been that way for 2.5 years. And the other big difference is that, you know, they went after Clinton for lying about having sex with, which, you know, if we're honest, I think most adults have done at one point or another. And this is about obstructing justice and abusing the office of the presidency. And those are things that we haven't all done at some point. So I think that it's just a sloppy or superficial analog.
Fair enough. Okay. And so, and I think, look, the arguments as to whether it would help or hurt cut both ways. Here is my question for you. And I'm still, I think, formulating my opinion, but there's no doubt in my mind that we're already, you know, walking down the path of impeachment. I mean, you know, it's possible all these investigations will turn up nothing and maybe we'll get none of this information. But in one form or another, and I think you have a compelling argument that to use the word impeachment, even if it's just an inquiry, is going to sort of elevate the importance of this investigations in the public's mind. Here is my question to you. Is there a danger that you do the impeachment process? Again, I think that seems to me to be a wise course. But if you hold the vote to impeach before the election, and regardless of how it comes out, we know it's not going to go anywhere in the Senate, like you said. What if Trump wins the election again? Let's just assume it's a neutral impact on his election turns, the impeachment, one way or another. We can't measure it. But what if he wins? What do Democrats have in their quiver left for the second term? That's my fear.
Well, I mean, I think that the prospect of a second term is itself terrifying. And I don't know that it would be materially worse if they tried to hold him account and failed before that.
Well, they can't. Can they go back? I mean, or, A, can they? I imagine they could. But B, would they, in 2021, bring impeachment hearings against this guy, even if there was more information that came out?
I mean, it seems to me that the politics of that would be extremely fraught. And if we know Democratic leadership and their institutional concerns, I would say it's extremely unlikely. It's certainly possible. There's nothing that precludes them from doing so. It's not like double jeopardy.
Right.
But I would think that that would not happen. And I would also think that, you know, the new information that might be revealed is not as serious as the repeated attempts to obstruct justice that we found here, and also the refusal to comply with congressional oversight. That's a 1-2 punch that I think is very powerful.
Well,
and so my view is that they can damage him in hearings while the presidential candidates, the Democratic presidential candidates, talk about what they want to do for the country. And it's
Joshua Holland, I have a feeling this is a conversation we can have again soon. I appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me, Sam. I appreciate it.
Joshua Holland is a contributor to The Nation magazine. He also enjoys diving with sharks in his free time. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Check out ROFpodcast.com to support the show.